is Tony Gosling. Tony, welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Hi, Vinnie. Thanks very much for inviting me on.
Well, how are you today, my friend?
I'm in a good mood. And I actually love listening to your voice. I hate to say that. I mean, it sounds like I'm creeping up to you, but you've just got this kind of jaunty, kind of positive attitude to things. Of course, the world we're living in at the moment, it's like the Wicked Witch of the West is waving her magic wand. She's trying to turn everything that's in colour into black and white, and everywhere, you know, sort of going around sucking the soul out of things, sucking, you know, for example, over here, you know, we've got all of our public services slowly being bit by bit strangled, closed down. You know, we're talking about, you know, the dignity of the elderly is slowly being strangled by the money people. And, you know, what we need is people like you out there who are going to inject a little bit of positivity back into society to let people know that they can fight back. Because, you know, all this stuff to do with Occupy, where they've been talking about the 1%, you know, I've actually sat down and worked it out, as many others have. It's not at all the 1%. In fact, I'll tell you, somebody who even told me this is a European commissioner in charge of jobs and trade. That is the biggest civil servant in the whole of Europe, a guy called Laszlo Andor. He was on the radio show we do in Bristol every week, and he explained it's the 0.0015% that are responsible for the mess we're in. And these are the main people who are really benefiting from it. We're not talking about even the middle classes or the upper classes. We're talking about the superpower elite, which is a tiny, tiny fraction of humanity, who seem to be hell-bent on literally turning the world into a cesspool whilst they thrive on the takings of thieving everything from everybody. And I think, ultimately, what we're facing is a kind of almost like a Tolkien-esque battle with these people, almost like the Second World War or something, you know, really a massive, massive war with them, because they are hanging on to power, and we are basically banging our fists on the table in righteous anger, saying, you're not having it, yeah? But the good thing about it is that they are only a very, very tiny, you know, disease-brained cult minority. And, you know, we've got every chance of winning this, ultimately. I mean, not only that, you know, you and I know that we're in a situation where good, actually, even though it might not seem like it, always will triumph over evil.
Well, it's not so much that good always triumphs over evil. They both lose and they both win.
When the chips are really down at the end of the day, there's no way somebody like Adolf Hitler can go around running the world. They can try. Of course, they spend a lot of time getting their act together, but ultimately they're going to get smashed.
Adolf Hitler financed himself, okay? He was financed by the Rothschilds, or the same people who finance us all today.
Yeah, but he was elected by the German people in a democratic election. They welcomed him originally with open arms, you know, because they thought he was really helping them out in a difficult financial situation, not unlike the one we seem to be heading into right now. But, I mean, it's just a question of understanding that the Bilderbergers and these people that I've got a website on have started the death spiral off. They're also trying to close off all of the solutions to the economic death spiral. You know, all the basic sensible things like exiting from the Eurozone, taking back your sovereignty, printing your own currency, deciding to take control of your own money. They're closing that one off simply by making sure it's not discussed, number one. And anyone that does discuss it is told, look, you're talking rubbish, you're talking nonsense. I mean, even the Greeks, they're trying to manage to persuade the Greek people to stay in the Eurozone, even whilst it's strangling them. The other thing, of course, is nationalising these private banks, which are strangling the economy, to take those over, you know, nationally, and organise them for the benefit of the people is just simply taboo. So, you know, this death spiral is growing and growing in Europe, and it's about 2 years now we've had this Eurogeddon crisis going on. And meanwhile, people are actually dying. You know, people are dying for lack of health care. They're dying from lack of food and jobs in some parts of Europe as well. People now are totally dependent on food handouts. And this is slowly strangling. I mean, obviously, this is happening in the US too and in other parts of the world. But Europe is not used to this kind of thing, except back in the 1930s.
Well, see, you know what I found was interesting? I'm talking to a lot of elders, my elders, right? And this and back in the day, man, everybody had plenty of money. So basically, unemployment was like, what was that? And it was fine. The economies were all working fine. And then after they sell off all the national assets and start bringing in the IMF and the World Bank, suddenly we've got a poverty crisis. And people go, oh, it must be those terrible right-wingers cut everybody's taxes. Or no, it can't be those. It must be those leftists growing the size of government. Well, actually, we are the 99.9999995%, okay? All right? And this
index can,
and it just comes down to the fact that these politicians, as you said, were kind of like these little servants to the Wicked Witch of Oz or what have you, you know, like the little monkeys with the little hats and the wings and such like that. Just fly, my
well,
baby.
I know when I don't know about you, Jenny, but when I saw the stuff on the telly with the NATO people and the G8 people, I just think of the Eyes Wide Shut film by Stanley Kubrick, which he talks about, you know, the real super rich and real super powerful in this kind of surreal world. And that's the way I see them. I think that they are completely detached from the rest of us. They have absolutely no concern for anybody except themselves. And they live in this kind of Zardoz world. I don't know if you've ever seen that. That's another good feature film by John Borman, where they are the elected leaders. They basically made themselves into gods on Earth, and we will just have to do everything they say. And they do this simply by co-opting the mainstream media. I mean, the BBC, which I used to work for, I worked for them as a researcher and a reporter, then a journalist for 3 years here in Britain. The original BBC director general, the guy that started it all back in the 1930s, is Lord Reith. Now, he was the man that kept the anti-Hitler voices off the airwaves. He was actually a pro-Nazi himself. When Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia, he was banging his fist on the table, hooray, hooray, isn't it wonderful? This man is doing what loads of people haven't dared to do. So right from its very, very start, what a lot of people don't realise is the BBC was run by a pro-Nazi, by basically one of the 0.0015%. And he had to be actually kicked out of his job in order to allow Winston Churchill to have the first voices on the British airwaves here back in 1938 and 1939, saying, well, actually, guys, we've got to watch Hitler. This guy's dangerous. And so you can see that even from its conception, broadcasting has been used basically to stick a ring in people's noses and lead them around. And that's why, for me, it was quite an interesting experience to be part of the BBC in the days before it became so utterly controlled as it is now. When we had a little bit of freedom, you know, I was working in a radio newsroom doing the nightly news on the radio for whatever, something 7-8 million potential listeners in London, and you know, working with some fantastic people. But nowadays, what I look at and see the BBC serving up is something absolutely appalling. There's no real proper analysis. And what they're doing, basically, is stenography. It's not journalism. It's just copying. What they're doing is they're cutting and pasting press releases and sticking them up on our screens as if there's the truth. And there's almost no proper critical analysis. And this goes back, I suppose, to what I'm saying about the real solutions to this, very, very simple solutions to. And, in fact, if you want to make it even simpler, just do what Iceland did. You know, this is so obvious, it should be written right across the airwaves and all on all the headlines. Iceland has sorted out its economic difficulties, which were mainly caused by a couple of Brits that went in there and privatised a lot of their banking in Iceland, and they've sorted it all out now. So why can't we just do the same?
Right, we'll talk about Iceland after the break, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, it's the show, fabulous, Tony Goldman is right here.
Get no relief. Businessman there to drink my wine.
good show. The show that's all about scumbaggery coming to take over the earth, like the Bilderberg Club and those various other monkey-like demon-worshipping servants of the New World Order having their big wild sex orgies, you know. And I must say, even a mask would not help Hillary Clinton in that scenario. What we talked about there was nationalizing the major corporate banks, and I suggested this to a group of socialists a couple of years back when they were protesting against ASB, which was basically just cracking unions over the head and screwing over all the things and everything like that, because I thought this was a much better idea. Because think about it, who's got the biggest buildings in every city? The major corporate banks. How on earth is everybody else living in abject poverty in crappy little places that they can't even afford to keep warm anymore because the electricity prices are too high? And the major corporate banks who push paper and click buttons all fracking day build the biggest, fanciest establishments on earth. You gotta be kidding me. And people don't see it. And they're the biggest things right there in front of their face. Tony Gosling is my guest, and you were talking about Iceland and how they shook off the banks. Could you actually begin again?
Well, yeah, the Icelandics. I mean, it's a tiny little island. You know, it's almost like this, the ruins of Atlantis out in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean. What they did essentially is they just stepped in. They said, "By the way, all these massive debts that you have." construed over the last several years, we're just not going to pay them, and we're taking you over. And they just reappointed to the banks people that were appointed by their government, and kicked out the people, several who were Brits, who had been leading the Icelandic economy down a drain. It was just a fairly brave thing. It was essentially about, look, who's in charge in this country? Is it the government or is it a few foreign private bankers who happen to own a business here? And they passed a bit of legislation, it was only several pages of legislation through their parliament, and just kicked out the Brits and the private bankers and took over the bank themselves. And, you know, ultimately, this is really what sovereignty is about, of course. It's about, you know, us electing people to organise the money system. This is the most important thing in any economy, in any country nowadays, you know, because it is about sharing out resources. Now, you have to just think to yourself, do you want private individuals sharing out those resources for their own private profit and making decisions based on what is going to be good for them and their shareholders, or do you think that we should have individuals that we elect making those decisions for the people? Well, you know, it's not much of a choice, is it? And so that's what the Icelandics did. The thing is, I mean, you know, there's no, absolutely nobody in Europe that I can see in anywhere on the mainstream media, even people like Ben Chu in the independent newspaper, who's pretty broad-minded, and it may be simply that he's frightened to write about this, but it is obvious this is what you do. You just look at how long out of the crisis, and you just replicate it for other big countries in Europe.
Tony, how long ago did they do that?
About 2 years ago. It was just towards the end of when Gordon Brown was our Prime Minister, and the Icelandics have just shown the way. As usual, you know, they showed the way back in the Viking days, didn't they? They were pretty, they were a bit ruthless in those days, but they were certainly, you know, high-tech. And I think, in a way, it's the fact that it's, you know, it's a country which wasn't really on the big G8 kind of, on these big countries' radar screen. And so they were able to actually assert their democratic rights. Now, I mean, you know, the fact is we have the City of London, which is a dominant factor in British politics, for example, and it's very, very difficult for any of the politicians to get anywhere in any political party in this country without being endorsed by the City of London. For whatever reason, there's very, very few independent minds. I mean, we've had a few. One of them was John Smith, who was the leader of the Labour Party before Tony Blair was. He died in mysterious circumstances. And then we had Robin Cook, who was quite principled foreign secretary under Blair, And he also died in mysterious circumstances. So, you know, you don't need to be a genius to work out that there's a lot at stake here and that people are prepared to bump people off, senior politicians, in order to get their way. And I think that's what's been going on over the last, basically, 30, 40 years since we had the last honest Prime Minister, who was a Labour Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, and even he was booted out by the MI5, who were bugging and burgling their way around the elected government's homes in order to harass them out of office, which they did in 1975. So it's been a long time since we've had any real democracy here in Britain, the so-called mother of parliaments, even though we seem to be very, very good at congratulating ourselves for spreading democracy around the world, along with the US. You know, we've got absolutely no right to do that because we're not democracies ourselves. We're oligarchies controlled by this 0.00... No, I hope you won't get too bored with me saying it, but the 0.0015%. You know, we've got every chance of beating these people, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. And just how much growth has Iceland had in the recent economy? Like, have they only just turned the corner?
No, they began almost straight away, getting their economy going. And now they're showing a healthy chug. Now, you have to remember that Iceland is in the context of the whole of the rest of Europe, which is very much flatlining generally, apart from a couple of countries like Germany. In Britain, the economy is going down again. It's a double-dip recession. It's a big surprise there. But that's because we've got a Bilderberger for our Prime Minister and a Bilderberger for our Chancellor of the Exchequer. This is back to the old days in the late 1700s of the Hellfire Club. This was a club run by Sir Francis Dashwood, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer 200 years ago or so. And he was running a satanic sect where they were having orgies and all this kind of thing. And he was outed at the time, but only after he'd been kicked out as Chancellor of the Exchequer because he was making such a mess of the economy. The difference is now we've got a Chancellor who's made a total mess of the economy, and yet he's still in his job, and he will continue in his job. These people are like limpets nowadays. Nothing will shame them into moving. And I'm just hoping that possibly the Murdoch inquiry, the whole Leveson inquiry, which has been exposing the News of the World phone hacking and bribes being paid by News International to the Metropolitan Police. They had all sorts of, you know, basically brown envelopes with thousands of pounds in cash going into Scotland Yard, paying police for information about, you know, crime stories and this kind of thing. As that all comes out, and the fact that the Prime Minister's own personal private press secretary was the guy who was the news editor at the News of the World at the time, that is Andy Coulson, was right in the middle of all this, that actually may be a political scandal that removes this government. I think that's actually the best prospect we've got to get rid of these crooks. And they are basically a government by the millionaires, because we've got 13 millionaires in our cabinet, by the millionaires, for the millionaires, and the people just simply don't get a look in. The fact of the matter is, though, people are getting angry, people are getting really annoyed, and I'm really glad to see that there's looks like there's going to be a big protest this year at the Bilderberg Conference in Chantilly. You know, this is one of the most important places to do a protest, never mind the G8, NATO, or anybody like that, because the Bilderberg really is the belly of the beast. I don't know if you would agree, Vinny.
It's certainly the most public belly of the beast that we're capable of actually gathering around that we know about.
Well, that's true, in that the Council on Foreign Relations is probably another one. That's fairly public, although there's never any protests, hardly ever any protests there. And also, not a lot of people realise that it was back in 1943 that the Council on Foreign Relations actually first came up with the Bilderberg Group as a concept. This is during the Second World War, you know, basically just even before D-Day. They decided that, yes, we are going to win this war, but what's going to happen afterwards? We need to make sure we control the outcome. The fact was that the Council on Foreign Relations were actually rather close to the Hitler regime, and they were very friendly with some of the people who'd been running the industries. They were looking enviously at the concentration camps, at the labour camps, and saying, this is great, isn't it? Look, all these slave labour going on over there. And in fact, there was a visit by John D. Rockefeller before 1943, before the US entered the war. over to visit concentration camps. There are some photographs, and you probably find them online somewhere, of John D. Rockefeller actually touring around concentration camps, admiringly looking at, one of the Germans or the Nazis have actually done it. Isn't this wonderful? Look, slave labour, just stick people in jail. And, of course, America is very, very good at that. I mean, we're starting to privatise our prison system over here, but once you stick people in jail and you're starting to incentivise incarceration, then you've got all the makings of a, basically a labour camp-style, concentration camp-style system. And that's what they were admiring at the Council on Foreign Relations. So, of course, they were quite happy in the Bilderberg conferences to do deals with European industrialists, and particularly the chairman of the Bilderberg of the day, which was Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was himself a former SS officer from the 1930s. You know, he'd been in the SS uniform, and there he is, chairing the very first ever Bilderberg conference. So you don't need to be a genius to work out that these people are actually Nazis. They don't wear swastikas, but they certainly are, and they're an economic Nazi force,
Wasn't one of the monarchs of England publicly...
Well, he was, you're thinking about Edward VIII. Edward VIII, this is in 1936, 1937. He was, openly supported Hitler, as did, as I said, the Director General of the BBC back in the 30s. And he had to abdicate because he was in love with a woman called Wallis Simpson, who's American, but she was also a Nazi agent. She'd wheedled her way into his underpants, the king, you know, the Nazis had got the biggest prize in Britain, which was the king. And so he had to be sort of shuffled off sideways, embarrassingly, and the job was taken by his brother, who was King George VI. What a lot of people don't realise, though, and John Loftus told me this on the programme we do in Bristol every week, I do a current affairs show in Bristol on the radio, was that Edward and Mrs. Simpson, they actually made it across to France. They were touring around. This is right at the very beginning of World War II, the end of 1939, beginning of 1940. And they actually tried to get across the border into the Nazi territory, into Nazi Germany. And they were arrested by MI6, the British intelligence people. Good God, we can't have the former king going over to the Nazis. That would be a propaganda coup for Hitler. We can't have King Edward VIII broadcasting on the radio across Europe saying how wonderful Hitler is. So MI6 arrested him, and he was then sent off to the Bahamas, and he was made the governor of the Bahamas and kept well out of the way for the rest of the war. So you can see there was, there still is, I think, high sympathies amongst the highest echelons in British society, particularly amongst the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family, which, of course, Edward and George VI were part of, very, very sympathetic with the Nazis. They saw themselves as the leaders, the gods, if you want, and the people were their subjects, and if it would make an efficient country by putting the people in concentration camps and forcing them to work for slave labour wages in factories, then so be it. I mean, that's just their idea of an efficient way to run a country.
And all this is kept out of the headlines, and you find it's very interesting. You can predict what kind of policy particular governments and particular individuals are going to propose if you have a look at what kind of stuff that they've done in the past. And you have a look now, okay, that's right. Most of our leaders and the ones who are actually in control of the parties and the media and the police and all of that kind of stuff are basically fascist, jackbooted thugs who have no concern for our rights whatsoever and want a vicious, tyrannical police state in a dark age of humanity forever. Okay. Now
yeah, they're control freaks, really.
Sense.
I mean, that's basically it. And also, they have an incredible inflated view of their own abilities, and they do see themselves as the natural kind of, basically what happens is, imagine you or I, if we were to start getting wealthy. I mean, I don't own my own home or anything like that, but, I mean, say I'd got my own mansion, and then I managed to make more money, and I got my other three or four mansions, and then I got, a nice yacht, one of those big super yachts, that was a few more million, and then I got, had loads of prostitutes, I had loads of whatever I wanted, on and on and on and on and on. Ultimately, what you then want is you start wanting power and influence. You want to control newspapers, you want to control television stations, you want to control arms companies, you want to control those kinds of things. Okay, once you've got hold of some of those, once you've taken over a few of those and you're mates with the people that run them, then you want to start taking over the House of Commons. You want to start taking over the Senate. You want to start taking over the House of Representatives. You want to start taking over Parliament. And this is a toxic, real toxic combination. And this is what these people have succeeded, slowly but surely, in doing, is basically through the aggrandizing of wealth, they're now taking over all of those basic things that we need in order to have any kind of sane society. So society is definitely going down the tubes. I mean, I don't think, you know, we don't really need to be told much more about that. The fact is, what's happening, certainly with the youth, is the...
Well, hold on, Tony. Conveniently, we don't have to talk about any more of that because we're coming to a break. Just kind of like the totalitarian corporate takeover tiptoe. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. You can even join us in the chat room there. Back in a tick.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky.
There's a shadow coming over the sky. It's called the British Empire, ladies and gentlemen. And the sun never sets on Britannia's holdings because it never rises either, because they want to keep you perpetually in darkness, bondage, and slavery. Thank you, Cecil Rhodes. You, diamond in the rough, you, with your seven secret wills formed to use your vast wealth. Anybody ever heard of Rhodesia? It was named after this dude, Cecil Rhodes. He plundered copious quantities of diamonds and gold and goodness knows what else out of that country. And then when he died, he was basically the richest man in the world. And he drew up these seven secret wills. Only one of these wills has actually ever been revealed. Have you ever heard of the Rhodes Scholarship? That's what one of these seven giant wills were put out for. And G. Edward Griffin exposed that the rest of these wills were to finance different arms of a secret society that was had the express purpose of spreading the British Empire and its dominance, finance, laws, everything, everywhere, and to ensure its rule for all time. And we currently live in that society. Anybody who thinks that they live in a sovereign nation, no. Sorry. If you have a private bank issuing your currency, and trust me, we all do, and if you haven't, you'll be invaded soon, because that's what happens. We live under that rule, ladies and gentlemen, and we need to expose the Nazi roots behind it, and also the very cause and easy remedy to the solution. Nationalizing their banking cartel. They have control over our countries because they have control over our currency. Once they have that, they care not who makes its rules, allegedly. And my solution to the derivatives crisis is not entirely similar to that. You just have a look at the derivatives. Hey, here's a whole bunch of money that's made up and doesn't exist. Why don't we just pretend that it actually really doesn't exist? Oh, okay. Suddenly we don't have quadrillions and quadrillions of debt to worry about. Isn't that a fabulous and very creative solution? Well, at least I think so anyway. A solution to a problem that doesn't exist is pretending that it doesn't exist. Pretty straightforward, I would have thought. Tony Gosling is my guest. Welcome back.
Hi, Vinny. I agree with all you've just said there. One thing I would add, though, is that a lot of people think the British Empire is, oh, well, that's a long gone thing, you know. You're a New Zealander, are you?
That's right.
Yeah, because, you're sort of part of that so-called Commonwealth. Well, just to let you know, the Americans have always, the US has always hated the Commonwealth. I mean, not only just the idea of people holding their wealth in common, but it's actually the old-style Commonwealth. The Commonwealth Centre in London has been pretty much closed down. The Commonwealth Museum, which was in Bristol, where I live, is now totally defunct. They had the cheek to do a exhibition, and which was brilliant, actually, warts and all type exhibition, all about the 200th anniversary of the abolition of slavery, and within months all their funding had been pulled, so they've had to completely close down the Empire and Commonwealth Museum. But there is a sort of nasty side of the British Empire that still lingers, of course, and that is the royal family and all their pals. I don't know if you had it on the news over there, but we had the biggest meeting ever of kings and queens and princes and princesses from around the world in Britain last Friday. They all got together at Windsor Castle, which is the home of the Order of the Garter, which has been going since medieval times, which is basically 26, that's 2 times 13, covens of knights surrounding the royal family. So ever since medieval times, that they had the liars' lunch there last Friday, and then they had the dictator's dinner at Buckingham Palace in the evening. So this is still actually quite a powerful network, and the idea that you've got the King of Bahrain sitting down with other kings and queens from around Europe just to have a nice little dinner, you know, gives you an idea that there's still quite a lot of power out there, that everyone that comes to Britain to do this kind of thing. So there's a sort of, I don't know, weird kind of respect for Britain that a lot of these people seem to have, which, I mean, I certainly don't have any respect. You know, I have love, but not respect for the actions of the King and Queen. I mean, John Morgan over in Australia has just brought out the last, I think, in his series of books about the murder of Princess Diana, well, the assassination, really, of Princess Diana. And, you know, that's definitely my view. My contact,
we had him on the show.
You know, would all say that the present Queen and Duke of Edinburgh were definitely in the loop when it came to the decision to assassinate Diana, basically because she was just about to take Princes Harry and William off on holiday with Dodi Al-Fayed, and they were going to have a fantastic, gorgeous week away from this Wicked Witch of the West kind of thing that is the British royal family. And I don't think if they'd been on that week, they would ever have wanted to come back again. You know, basically because of the stifling atmosphere amongst many of the people in the current royal family. So there is still this British Empire. You're absolutely right about Cecil Rhodes, of course. He did create a network after his death, this thing called the Royal Institute for International Affairs in London and the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States. Both, all of these received money. I don't think it was necessarily a British Empire thing, but it was an attempt to privatise foreign policy right across the world. And that's essentially what they've done. And the other thing is the BBC are partners at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, so whenever there's a new problem comes up in a country around the world, who pops up on the TV to tell us all about it? Oh, it's somebody from Chatham House. The Royal Institute for International Affairs will tell us all how it's going to transpire. So they have basically privatised the whole idea of what used to be the job of the Foreign Office and the State Department. These people are really basically now just a sideshow. All the foreign policy journals, both the Sun-style, tabloid, you know, newspaper-style things, and the more highbrow broadsheet newspapers are all churned out by the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Council on Foreign Relations, people like this. And that is basically the way things are done. And the Foreign Office, even if somebody in the Foreign Office thought, well, maybe it's not a good idea to nuke Iran, the fact that it's already been decided by everybody at the CFR is really down to Cecil Rhodes and his rather evil plan all those years ago to privatise foreign policy right across the world with this kind of Hydra network of interconnected institutes of private institutes of foreign policy. So, that's exactly what's happened. And Bilderberg, of course, is very much closely linked in with these networks. The same people go to Royal Institute for International Affairs and Council on Foreign Relations as go to the Bilderberg. The other thing that just really worries me about the way that Bilderberg is going is that they really are taking on all the big internet people. Facebook, Amazon, LinkedIn, Google, these types are always now at the Bilderberg conferences. The other big change in the last year's meeting at St. Moritz in Switzerland was that we also had some of the senior people from the Chinese finance ministry over too. So that was the first time I've ever seen anybody really from outside the NATO countries with any sort of serious clout invited along to a Bilderberg conference. And that's a really important thing, I think, for people to realise, is that basically that the Chinese Politburo is now being sucked in on the Bilderberg train of thought, which is really pretty concerning. Mind you, it's not totally surprising, since their attitude to human rights and to people's general well-being is exactly the same as that of the Chinese. Essentially, they want to control as much as they can. They have no interest in people's freedoms, and they'll just do as much as they possibly can that they can get away with that will make bring more power to themselves. And so, you know, I can see quite happily Henry Kissinger, the organizer of the 1973 coup in Chile, which led to the deaths of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, sitting down quite comfortably with these Chinese leaders at this next Bilderberg conference in Chantilly. Good thing is, of course, that there is going to be quite a sizable protest. I noticed that the Intel Hub, Alex Jones and others, are really pushing it this year. And I think if anybody of your listeners has never been to a Bilderberg meeting, there is so much positive to say about get yourself down there, because it is fascinating. The people you meet, first of all, are really interesting. It's incredibly empowering being with other people who can see the way that these fascists are trying to control our world. And you get this kind of force multiplication when everybody's in the bar in the evening. So everybody's like bouncing off each other. It's one of the most exciting places in the world to be, is the Contra Bilderberg hotel. You know, that's the place to be. And also, of course, it's a really positive to have so many people down there who are all able to actually get the word out about what's actually happening, and possibly even, you know, actually occupy the hotel, which is what they're talking about this year, is actually occupying the Bilderberg hotel rather than just sitting around outside, getting inside and getting right in their faces.
You know, with that big royal meeting that you're talking about, and seeing if we had any media coverage, you know, they reported instead that there was a car crash and two students from the US died because they weren't wearing their seatbelts. and also on the Diana inquest, I had John Morgan, the guy who literally wrote the books about the Diana inquest, on the show last week, and we got some archives there if you want to check that out, ladies.
Yeah, I will do. Yeah, thanks a lot. I think he's done an absolutely brilliant job, and he's not just coming at it from a Republican Australian point of view. He's looking at it basically because it is almost an undoable thing here in Britain. I mean, we had Keith Allen's film, which is also brilliant. I don't know if you've seen that, from last year, called gosh, what's the name of it? It's the verdict that there was in the inquest against Diana. Unlawful killing, that's right. And that has not still been shown in Britain anywhere. It's actually apparently supposed to be illegal to show it, because the Duke of Edinburgh has asked or demanded legally for lots of cuts in it. But it's absolutely brilliant film. You can see it online. I think you have to go to Press TV, their YouTube channel, and they did a review program of large parts of the film about Diana's death. So, you know, it's absolutely brilliant what he's done. And he's, you know, this is lifting a weight from our shoulders, because everybody who ever met Diana, as I had the pleasure to do, knows that she was an absolutely wonderful woman. She was honest. She was exactly what we need in this world, which is a really honest, loving, good leader. And so, therefore, just like John Smith before her and Robin Cook, who I mentioned earlier, she was dispatched. You know, this is, I'm afraid.
We're coming to break, Tony, unfortunately.